Blog Talk Radio.
Home Companion. I'm going to be your host for the next 90 minutes. My name is Dale Graham, but you can call me Graham. My mother does. Anyway, we need to catch up. So much has been happening and going on. This is right now the 2nd of June. I'm going to apologize a few times during the show. I'm still a bit short of breath. I've been running around with pneumonia, and so I'll try and keep the gulping and gasping to a minimum. This is, of course, June 2nd, the 153rd day of the year, and I hope that you will have set in your mind a special moment coming up on the 21st of June, and if you can, be awake at 4 minutes after 5 in the morning. I know that wouldn't be unusual around the Graham household. That will be the moment of balance, summer solstice, the moment summer starts in our hemisphere. The world will be in balance. No, it won't. That will be the time of the longest day. We're looking for equinox. We've already passed the balance point. So we're going to be looking at the longest day and the shortest night. I think we know historically connects us with the ancients, those of us who looked up at the heavens and began noticing the changes that happened and reconciling those changes with periods and seasons, times of the year, anticipating weather patterns. That information is still up there, and we've just continued to pursue it, as curious as we always have been, trying to find answers. And now it seems that the new research is taking us further afield to the very edge, to that moment of the beginning of time. And it's kind of coincidental, isn't it, that while we do that, we stretch ourselves out there, we also stretch ourselves internally to new research into the mind to try and understand the workings of a human being in ways that we haven't before. Still curious, still posing questions to the best and brightest. Who knows where the answers will come? Sometime, as we know, the solutions to weighty complications come by observation, something that we observe unintentionally, an unintentional outcome to an experiment. This isn't to say that we should subscribe to a randomness in our work or our daily lives. After all, we live in a world of probability. I want to talk now a bit more about about some things Masonic, of course, and of course being aware that the time passes us by. Did you know that it was about 40 years ago that the first email was sent? 40 years ago. Hmm? Are we lamenting the day? Only if we're tragically lost in our thoughts, I suspect. We have been walking along. Imagine that we're walking along a great long beach, and every so often, one of the shells seems to be spectacular, and we pick it up and carry it with us, or we collect them. And as we go down the beach, we'll never find one quite exactly the same again, but we may find something that is also attractive. Maybe it's a pebble or a shiny bit of quartz that's been polished with the action of the waves, the passage of time. So we have events and people in our lives that we will collect like those attractive and interesting bits along our path. At any one point, it would seem, of course, ridiculous for us to stop and say, we don't want the beach to continue from this moment. I have found perfection. Everything that I see, everything that I've experienced behind me is all that I need. What a profoundly limiting a statement. Nobody would ever expect a thoughtful man, particularly a Freemason, to say so. I'm going to talk to you a bit today about the International Conference in the History of Freemasonry. And some of you will know that a Masonic Home Companion was over there and did slide into London for a little bit and over to Edinburgh to do some research. And I'm going to bring that back and share that with you. And, of course, this is a shameless plug for the International Conference in the History of Freemasonry coming up in May of 2015 in Niagara. And I hope that over the course of the show, I think we need to talk about the direction that we're taking in Freemasonry and some of the caveats and some of the questions, serious questions, I think legitimate questions that need to be asked. We have, and before I go on, I'm going to try and remind you, remind me at the end of the show if I forget. Go get into the internet and look for a CBC show called Quirks and Quarks, Quirks and Quarks. It's run by, it's the host of that program is Bob McDonald. Now, the other day, he did a program called Canada 2050. Our future, I'll just bring it up here, our future in a changing climate. It is one of, I found, it's about, I think the show was about an hour long. It is one of the most profound things that I've heard in a long, long time. He had a host of experts, of scientists, talking about our future in a changing climate, talking about the effects. Not, oh, gee, things are going to get hotter, but what Canada will be like in 2050, the changes that we see happening now, and if we just drew a line at 2050, what Canada will likely experience, people like us will experience in 2050. Now, a lot of you will be around then. If I am in 2050, I'll be a very, very old Canadian and a very, very old Mason. And I hope still engaging and conversational, and not just in my own mind. But this is Quirks and Quarks, Canada in 2050, Our Future in a Changing Climate, by Bob McDonald. And there is a podcast on it, I understand. He has a list of scientists. And the portions that were profound was the effect, what the forests will be like, where the effects will be of the change will most likely be, will be the greatest. And then, of course, that will be dramatic change that is going to happen up in our north. The animals will probably not be able to adapt as quickly as the environment. And so we'll see the animals that have been able to survive because of their adaptability to harsh climates being pushed out by animals that don't have that capacity but won't need it because the climate won't be so harsh. So one of the scientists even spoke about the possibility of black bears up along the high reaches of the Arctic. Now, life in our towns, the kind of food that we'll eat and the way we will connect with each other, the not just change in water, but what the effects of the change in temperature is going to mean for us. And we're not talking about major, well, you know, it is major in terms of our environment, but we're talking about 2 to 4 degrees. And I won't get into all of it. It was an absolutely fascinating program. But for Masons, I think it's important for us to have a sense of context, not wringing our hands and gnashing our teeth, but awareness. We need to be able to sit back and understand. Now, a lot of things that go on in our world may not please us, may not be to our liking. But there's a certain point of maturity in our thinking when we realize that it's really possible for us to develop a sense of observation so that we can begin to understand and not be so reactive, not be so caught up in our own emotional response to events going on in our lives. If nothing, Freemasonry teaches us to have that to gain self-control, we need to be able to develop skills of observation. Now, life goes on, doesn't it? Certainly does. It's only been 66 million years since the dinosaurs disappeared. We certainly haven't been around as nearly as long as the dinosaurs are on the face of the earth. We're not able to see all of them, although there's been a woolly mammoth with actual blood samples been found in a frozen region. I think that was from Russia, which is kind of interesting, you know, to be able to take a look at the DNA. What we'll do with that, you know, is that a Hollywood fantasy that we're going to see woolly mammoths growing and walking around theme parks? The more we study and learn about our history, the more we correct, mankind corrects myths and misunderstanding with fact. And even when we find new facts, we always have to be prepared for what tomorrow's going to bring. You know, the research doesn't stop because we have a new finding. And with all of this information comes greater responsibilities. And I think Freemasons have been experiencing that for quite some time. I think today we find a lot of useful information that may cause us a bit of concern, because it we have to put it into a contemporary context. We of course have depended largely on indifference. I want to ask you, brethren, have we been indifferent to the stretching ourselves academically? I think that's a bit of a complication that we need to creep up on in Masonry. We can all love the idea of education, but we seem to associate education with a way of defining or redefining Freemasonry. And I think that's a bit of a misnomer. I think it's perhaps that our attention is being drawn to it again. There. So can we honestly say to each other that our research it has reached a point where we can be objective and critical. I would say some research by Masons, some of the papers that I read and that we experience, and I'm not claiming to be the Library of Congress here. I'm not the librarian that's had a chance to go through all of the archives, but it's been my experience, and perhaps more consistent as the years go by, that I seem to have to praise the effort rather than the content. And I don't mean to be, of course, condescending in any way. The effort is important. We want to, part of my role and my responsibility to brethren, and I think that a responsibility that we share, is to encourage one another. And it's up to the man to sort, isn't it? Each one of us experiences our sense of limitations or not. And just when we discover one limitation and we try to resolve that and keep that in mind, we find there's another. We are, after all, complex and imperfect. So there's always work to be done. But to go back to the point that I'm making here, Freemasonry, it's difficult for us to be objective and critical when we're facing our brethren, who are going to be encouraging, but also perplexed, I think, because I think there is a considerable amount of confusion between critical thought and criticism. Critical thought is not criticism. It is a way of, it's a method, I would say, of determinism. Being able to understand something not as we want it to be, not as we want it to be to meet our emotional response. We want to be satisfied with something, or we want to like something, or we want people to like us, but as we are, to be able to look into the mirror and not just see what we want to see, but what we need to see. The difference between our opinion and truth. Now, that's very hard, because the truth can be harsh, especially if it's in the hands of somebody that doesn't know how to treat it with respect. It can be painful, and we don't want that, and we certainly, I don't think, need that. But we absolutely do require critical thought to help us understand more clearly what it is we are and what our potential can be. Now, we've relied on some scholars that we read in your Masonic library. We have some people that have been, we consider, pivotal. Masons writing to other Masons generally. If I was to say to you, isn't that a bit self-serving? You could say, well, Dale, if I'm a chemist, I want to read the works of the greatest chemists of the world. If I'm a physicist, I want to read the works of the physicists. Of course, I'm going to read the scholarly works of my people who get it, who understand my own field. Others of you might say, well, does that mean that we have a tendency to a bias because of our training? Well, yeah, there is some validity in that. And we can see that in the works of Higgs. Do you remember Higgs, of Higgs boson? Well, he came up with the idea of that as a theory in 1964. And Dr. Higgs at the time wasn't supported. And then he developed the idea that the actual theory could be developed experimentally. And just recently at CERN in Switzerland, we've seen the particle collider show us, quote, a proof that the Higgs boson does exist. Now, we won't, it's tempting to get into the physics of that right now, but I'm not a physicist, and that wasn't the point. The point is that he was saying something that has been validated, but it wasn't necessarily considered valid at the time. It was out there. It was an interesting thought. It caused concern. It raised questions. Now, that let's say very loosely that that's a big part of the scientific method, to challenge. This, I think, is one of the reasons why we need to rely on scholars to be able to help Freemasons develop the context of information that we rely on, that we need if we are going to understand. This isn't the getting back to the idiom, ignorance is bliss, where wisdom is folly. This is really getting into the idea that there is information out there, and courageous or not, there are facts that are redeveloping ideas about Freemasonry. The source of Freemasonry, the source of Masonic thought, if we're going to get into that, we're going to have to begin, I would suspect, by defining what Masonic thought is. What is anything Masonic? Is this branding? Is it like a Coke sweatshirt from Coca-Cola? Is that what we mean by Masonry? Is anything Masonic a brand? Or is there a particular uniqueness other than the group that are Masons saying, look, we are very special? Well, that seems to run counter to the grain of a lot of Masonic philosophy. And their angle, I use it very freely in my thinking, because I've been taught that to do things in a Masonic way is for me to strive for to do things based on a higher principle. Not just something that serves my needs, but to serve the needs of the greater good. In other words, to be able to sacrifice myself and feel good about it because I'm doing something for the greater good. And I am able to personalize that through the efforts and the experience of some wonderful lodges and incredible men that I've had the good fortune to meet through Freemasonry. But to get back to it, is there such a thing as something Masonic? Well, I'm going to hold that as a question right now because, to tell you the truth, I don't think I have an answer for it. You may, and I hope you do. And I hope when we meet, you can convince me of that or tell me why you think that is the case. But we need to rely on scholars to allow us to comfortably re-examine our own history and the influences that brought about the craft. The scholars don't have a vested interest in pleasing us. Just like the chemist doesn't necessarily have a vested interest in pleasing the world with their findings, or the physicists, or the mathematicians, or the sculptors, or the painters, or the songwriters or singers. I think what they're trying to do, what their effort is, and the fusion between arts and science has to do with appeal. Is there an honesty and an accuracy in the information, and that can be recognized by us? Can you imagine what it was like in 1906, 1909, when Picasso was starting to do his work? And people looked at him like this is an excuse for somebody that didn't know how to do a portrait. Only you'd have to be a fool to say that. If you saw any of his student work, it's breathtaking. It's exceptional. He was saying to us that doing that realism, doing that impressionism doesn't express enough. It doesn't express enough. We need another way, another form of expression to express the purpose, function, mass, the meaning. So he created, him and some other artists, created what we know as what? Cubism, what we know as the abstract, the abstractions. And it's not only valid, he demonstrated that if we begin to stretch our thinking, there is a way. Once you get it, there is another way of looking at the world, and it does reveal things that we may not have seen at the surface. Always penetration of the information. Eh? Bear with me. How am I doing so far? No, well, I don't think I'm doing so well. My voice is failing. Anyway, that's not why you're here. We're going to get on with going through. I want to give you a bit of a sample. This is, think of this like you've gone into this wonderful restaurant. You're in the company of some fabulous people. The conversation is very lively, and you have a bit of an appetite. You're finding as you walk into the place, the staff make you feel very, very comfortable. The music just happens to be your favorite. It's just dark enough. It's just light enough. And lively enough. And I want you, if you're in that frame of mind, whatever you're doing, sit back and listen. And I want to give you a bit of a sampler here. You look at the menu and it's just overwhelming. What, you know, how do you decide? So I want to give you a little bit of a, keep that in mind. And let me talk to you about the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry. This was the a little sampler. And I have a little bit of experience, so I can compare nuts to nutmeg here. And this was the fourth international conference, and it was held at Freemasons Hall on George Street in Edinburgh. I won't even get into what that's like. You can just imagine. Very distinct culture, wonderful culture, but not Canadian, and proudly able to see it, and so am I. I don't live in a Scottish culture here in Canada, and they don't live in a Canadian culture there in Scotland. It all works. So we've moved on from our reliance on the major research fields in Freemasonry that have been focused on scholarly effort. Are we on the same page that the most significant research into the one of the most legitimate forms of research in Freemasonry is through Ars Quattro Coronati, the premier research lodge of the United Grand Lodge of England? Can we agree on that? If you're doing better than their work, then it is, I'll apologize and say I stand corrected. That is a consistent, august, serious-minded group of Masons. Yes, we know you're going to say that there were the Canterbury conferences going on, that came to an abrupt end. That was around funding, not the idea. Funding problem. I talked to Dr. Jan Schnuck from Amsterdam just a week or so ago, and he talked with me about Canterbury. So, and we know Sheffield University had a program on studies in Freemasonry. My opinion on that wasn't able to be sustainable because the world and environment of universities has changed. Now, every department has been faced with, you know, their chancellors saying, why do you exist? Give me reasons why your department exists and what is the relevance to education at this school? That's the sorry state of higher education in our world, and I say sorry for some legitimate reasons. If there's anything that is not mainstream, it's going to fall to the wayside. That should be a concern to anybody, but probably more so to a small handful of people that can understand the impact that's going to have for years down the road. But we want to get into, as you saw from the introduction to the program today, I was talking about the debt owed to these great scholarly research fields. And you know that Masonic Home Companion is it feels that it's important for North America to have a chair of Masonic research. It doesn't exist today, but it could, and you could be part of it. That would be, I think, something that would be remarkable, both for posterity and in terms of the intellectual climate and growth and appeal and perhaps redefined legitimacy of Freemasonry in this era of changing communication, I believe is essential. It's this is not like sliced bread. This is more like inventing the wheel. This will do things for us that we cannot possibly account right now. And it is not a hope and a prayer. Those are discussions that we'll have later on Masonic Home Companion that need to be defined. And it should raise concerns, especially when one of you is brave enough to say, well, what's the relevance for Freemasonry? How will this? This is a leap of faith, because now we're stepping into something outside of Masonic control, aren't we? Oh, my. We're now looking at a reliance on the arts and sciences. Ah, we're being called. Ante up. This is what you say you are. Prove it. Of course, talk's cheap. No pun intended. This means not so much. The seriousness of this is to be able to dialogue on those kind of questions. The commitment, I think, the money will be there, of course, but that's not the commitment that's most important. We have to achieve some sense of between ourselves fraternally, some sense of intellectual currency, a meeting of the minds, truly a meeting of the minds. And we need to be able to do that so that we are inclusive. And that's going to put pressure, I think, that's going to require work from each one of us. To be able to find a way to maintain a feeling of inclusion, because this is a discussion, as we step into this atmosphere, this type of discussion, it increases the risk of feeling excluded. Yes, feeling excluded. So if you can't master that, it's like, oh, gee, here we are, and we're 7 years old, and we're going to learn to ride a bicycle, a two-wheeler bicycle, or we're 6 years old, or we're going to learn to ride a bicycle. Well, the risk is this problem of balance. So unless we're willing to take that risk, park your bicycle and shine it and keep it nice and waxed and clean. But if you want to whiz down the road to the local field so you can play a little bit of baseball with your friends, just learn to master it. That's the same similar kind of risk that we're going to face. It's a different kind of risk than our mothers would say, oh, you know, we have to have training wheels, we have to have helmets and pads, and I'm going to hold on to you very tightly so you can't possibly experience that risk on your own. At the start, it's probably wise, you know, it's like, you know, get the feeling of the back and forth. And then it's like, oh, once your brain understands what it is that's going on, you practice it. Now, some of us had the parent that said, I'm going to give you a shove, and you just keep pedaling, and you'll be fine. And so all of a sudden, boom, it's like you learn to swim by tossing you off the end of the pier. You go, yeah, okay. When infants, you see them, the infants are able to swim, and then we teach them to be afraid, and then we teach them anxiety. They hold their breath. Little people drown. So we want to be able to reach that understanding all by ourselves, but we have to take the training wheels off. We can't have that paternal hand holding on to our seat to protect us, and at the same instant say, well, you have to learn how to manage this skill on your own. You can't do both. This isn't a theory, it's a skill, it's a practice skill. So the risk here isn't balance. The risk is feeling excluded. And there's a back and forth in that. So the first time we feel excluded, well, we're going to fall off our bikes and scrape our knee, and we're going to scream and carry on if we're prone to that, or we're going to suck it up and say, hey, all right, that's a pain in the rear end. How do I avoid that? So you learn to coast around on your bicycle, a pedal, and then you look at the bike and you spin the wheels and you fool around with it and you get it. And you watch all your friends who are mocking you saying, hey, come on, get on your bike. And then so you're wobbly for a while, and then you realize your friends aren't wobbly, so you don't wobble your handlebars. And in a week, you're zipping around, and in a month, no hands, da-da-da-da. So all this in an age where helmets were what? Non-existent. And were we all concussed? No. We all learned to ride our bikes. And if we did things stupid, that had nothing to do with our skill set. That was what? Testosterone, adolescence. And that still goes on to this day. Anyway, the risk to us in opening up this conversation about our intellectual currency and about developing a more objective and critical thought within Freemasonry is this feeling of exclusion. And I think it's a tragedy. It's a skill that needs to be mastered, because it will be, if we can't master that in sufficient enough numbers, we're never going to achieve the goals that are possible. We're never going to have that. We're never going to venture down the road further, because we could use an axle, we could use a chain. We could use the exchange our muscle power into a mechanical energy, and we will never have the convenience of the pedal and gears and wheel. We can look at that and think that would be odd, wouldn't it? Not everybody rides a bike, right? Rightfully so. Not everybody has access to it, rightfully so. And it doesn't necessarily stop once you learn to ride a bike. Throw me the keys to the Vauxhall, and I'm away. Now it's not just how we drive; it's where we're going. For some, and we're able to do things and be in places in a broader range of time than ever before, and we have control. We have the sense of greater control. The only reason that occurred in the world that we have here in North America has developed is because large enough numbers of people were convinced. It did not mean that everybody was willing to put their horses out to pasture and put out their wagon and embrace cars, but enough did. And we knew after bouncing around on rutter roads for a while, we probably need something a little. So, of course, relying on the Scottish, they came up with something material called tarmac. And now we have these beautiful smooth surfaces for skateboarders and inline rollerbladers and Buicks and great grandmothers and young boys and girls to master this new method of travel. Doesn't mean where we go is more clever or more interesting. That's still up to us. Same with the idea of broadening Masonic education. The work is, if we feel excluded, we need to be able to examine that and talk out loud about it. Off the top of my head, I would say probably people that, if you don't have a PhD, you probably look at people with a PhD and say, they can do something that I can't. Well, generally, we would look at the amount of work and effort that it's taken to achieve that. If we are subscribed to Malcolm Gladwell's thinking, about 60,000 hours of work. 60,000 hours is that benchmark of effort, repeated effort, in order to achieve perfection, whether it's with the violin, whether it's with the an operatic voice, whether it's with the four-seam fastball. In order to reach levels of perfection, 60,000 hours. Push-ups in order to become a gymnast. You know, you 60,000, have you put in the 60,000 hours? And have you been fascinated by this small part of the world's ecology enough to put in that much time and find the meaning that you need to keep doing it day by day, and even when the findings are very obscure, knowing that you may get closer the next day or the next hour or the next minute? Well, Freemasonry is not too much different. We can still apply that same mindset to our goal, our work in Masonry. The work then is being able to maintain our focus. So, what can we learn collectively? And it's not a competition. What we need to keep in mind is this isn't a competition. And this isn't about, we have to learn to master our own passions in order to do this, I think. At a very base level, it can elicit in people that have this strong sense of lack of confidence or a sense of, it can bring forward a sense of inferiority. Oh, gee, in the world, there's somebody smarter than me. Well, no kidding, Einstein. Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily mean that each one of us doesn't or can't make a contribution. You can go and whine about it. Oh, gee, I don't like being around people that are smarter than me. Find your cave, close the door, find the dark corner of the lodge. Instead, you're brought into a fraternity where we're allowed to be who we are. We are allowed to admit very candidly that we are imperfect, that we can acknowledge effort in other people. In fact, you and I do that all the time. We encourage. Somebody stumbles over their ritual and it's not letter perfect and it's not something that's going to be on the stage at Stratford. Yes, we deserve that and yes, we want that, but we know that the fellow has put in a lot of time and it's a lot of work and he's distracted by a lot of things. So we encourage him with the hope that he will take that encouragement, not as sanctioning inferior quality work, it's that he already knows that, but that he feels safe to be able to take a risk. He feels safe that he's going to fall off his bike and we're not going to mock him with, hey, idiot, we're going to kid him as we would with brethren. Get up, you can do it, come on, we'll help you. We were all there, we all had to learn that skill at one point or another. And so it emboldens him. I remember a fellow that when he started doing his ritual, he would hold his breath. And the whole audience, you know, the lodge would sit there thinking, man, he's going to collapse. Nobody can go without oxygen that long. And his work was good. He was so transfixed. And then eventually I had the pleasure of seeing him as master. And he was relaxed and he was candid. He was able to anticipate. He was very, very good at his work. And we were able to even kid him like we would all. Do you remember a time when you didn't breathe? And do you remember what that did to us, sitting there watching him? Same kind of thing. We need to be able to encourage one another that this is something that is not new to Masonry, but it's new to us. Masonry at the highest levels has been based on the arts and science, the development of the arts and science, the embracing the arts and science, not controlling, not owning, not defining. Anyway, have I made the point? Have we made the point? Are we okay? Are we on the same page? I think we are. We've always sought to communicate, always, you and me and everybody, and our ancients. We've always sought to communicate beyond the person, beyond eye contact. So we leave a little symbol on a wall, and in our cave wall, a little painting that says, I was here and this is what I saw. These are the animals around me, and this was the hunt. And then we carved, and then we left symbols of our sense of metaphysics in our temples. And we have Celtic and Druidic symbols that are still with us today. And we're trying to translate and interpret, find out what the meaning of all of them is. And we do that by looking at context. What was the context? And doing that reveals some very, very interesting and compatible ideas. Very interesting. And it puts our who we are and our faith and our spirituality and, yes, our religion and politics into a context. And it puts our arts and science into a context. So have we established that? I think we have. We've always tried to communicate. So, yeah, we're going to be doing that in a greater sense. And we need to be able to do that on an intellectual level without, you know, wearing out the word intellectual. Get over the fact that we're all schoolboys. We're grown men. And there's things to be learned, and some things that are out there that are very granular, very, you know, difficult. Take time to grasp. Are we so limited in our approach that we need everything put through a blender and handed to us as if we don't have teeth? We can't chew it over? We can't adapt? There's no room for a new taste sensation? Is that what we've come to? Is meeting each other on the level truly stepping down even further? No. Meeting on the level is for me to pull myself up to your level and to work as hard as I can to pull myself up, to be able to take the challenge. That's me. That's the level. In my mind's eye, you collectively as my brethren are able to do more than I can, and I want to aspire to that. I want to be able to be suitable and proper in your company, not stepping down to the lowest to my common denominator. I need the challenge. I need the challenge that you present. I need to be able to be as patient as you are and as thoughtful as you are, and to be able to, when I find a dilemma, look at the world of masonry in a completely new and exciting way. I need that. We don't have these kind of conversations in lodges because that would be silly making. Oh my goodness, we couldn't do that. So, let me communicate with you through this vehicle, through a podcast. And let me tell you about a little sampler. The restaurant, the room that you're in has been so comfortable, so just the right temperature. The company has been scintillating. You have been witty and charming and relaxed, and you haven't even thought about the passage of time. This is a place you want to be. So we have this conference, the sampler that's coming to you, has to do with topics on Freemasonry. And this was spread over a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday morning. 2.5 days. Your day starts at 8 o'clock, and it wraps up with a reception at 19:30. What's that? 7:30. Fairly good day. 11.5 hour day. That's the first day. Next day starts at 8:45 and goes through to a dinner at 8 o'clock. And that goes on till about 11:30. And things are, yes. Oh my goodness, we're on time. For the most sake. And Sunday, you get to sleep in a little bit until 9:15. And then things break up about a quarter after 11. And even on the Sunday, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 papers are delivered. Lots of work. So here's a little bit of what you can expect. The first paper was The Rise and Fall of Empires, Britain and the United Grand Lodge of England's Compared, by J.W. Daniel. Of the United Kingdom. Few historians have examined Freemasonry in the context of the British Empire and its successors between the 1850s and today. The most important published work touching on this subject is still Jessica Harlan Jacobs' Builders of Empire, Freemasonry and British Imperialism, 1717 to 1927. Though, as the title indicates, her study stops in 1927, after the Balfour Declaration of 1926, which she calls a turning point in Anglo-Dominion relations, and the transformation of the British Empire into the British Commonwealth of Nations. In her conclusions, Harlan Jacobs comments that, quote, as the age of late empire gave way to the era of decolonization, British Freemasons were left with several unresolved issues, and states that it is clear that the same ideology that had long been used to build and maintain the empire could also be used to destroy the foundations up which it rested. Until 1855, Dr. Daniel explains, the only grand lodges in the British Empire were those in England, Ireland, and Scotland. In his paper, Grand Lodges in British Colonies, James W. Daniel concentrates on the period between 1850 to 1890, and therefore on the additional Grand Lodges formed in, drumroll, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand during that time. He concluded that these were neither imperial consolidators nor Commonwealth seedlings. I'm going to come back to that. He concluded that these were neither imperial consolidators nor Commonwealth seedlings, and that their independence foreshadowed the disintegration of the British Empire. It isn't what it was. Since 1927, however, nine more Grand Lodges have been formed. Commonwealth, as the residue of the British Empire is now called. A little harsh there, but in Africa, Australia, Canada, Europe, and India. So, you know, we have more than one Grand Lodge here in Canada. Thank you. This paper investigates the disintegration of what the Prince of Wales described in the 1880s as England's Masonic Empire from 1855 to the present, compares and contrasts it with disintegration of the British Empire, and considers the relations post-independence between London and its progeny. There you go. That's your plenary lecture from 10 o'clock in the morning. Good morning, everyone. That's it. Now we go on to the paper by the chair of the adjudicating committee. If you're going to do a paper for this, you have to submit it. The likes of you and I don't have the credentials to be to present the papers. No apology. This is at the top level. So I'll pull the ego back, bear down. We don't got it. I'll give you an idea. The next paper was offered by the chairman of the academic committee, and this is Professor Andrew Prescott from King's College in London. And I happen to think, personally, having listened to the man a few times, we listened to him in Washington, and then again in Scotland just not too long ago, this fellow is probably the foremost authority in Freemasonry, or one of the key foremost authorities in Freemasonry on the planet. So Prescott goes on. His topic is the Royal Arch in the Age of Uncertainty. Now, it's curious that, well, of course, we have in the Constitution that was written, Anderson's Constitution, we have a declaration that there are only three degrees in Freemasonry. But there is another little spot, and to complete the third degree, it has a little phrase about the Royal Arch, and it was unclear necessarily at the time, but it is still with us today, that three but, or that three and kind of a notion. The Union, and to complete it, you know, and you and I have heard reference to the fourth degree, that type of thing. Well, this starts to explore it a little more depth. The Union between the two English Grand Lodges in December 1813 recognized the Royal Arch as, quote, the completion of pure and ancient Freemasonry. And official events in London in 2013 will celebrate that bicentenary. However, it was not until 1817 that the organizational structure of the Royal Arch was clarified, and over 20 years before any attempt was made to standardize its rituals. For the Royal Arch, as with British history generally, in the period between the French Revolution in 1789 and the Reform Act in 1832, it was an age of uncertainty. Yet, as Andrew Prescott has written, exploring members' interest in the Royal Arch can tell us a great deal about their overall attitude to Freemasonry. Drawing on a socioeconomic analysis of Royal Arch members in London chapters amidst the political, economic, and social uncertainty of the period, this paper will reveal, and did, the complex and multidimensional social networks which existed and shed light on attitudes and commitment to the Royal Arch, despite a relative lack of contemporary institutional support. My, that seems similar to what we have today. A relative lack of contemporary institutional support, which, it is argued, was to be important in the development of Freemasonry in England later in the century. So that was a paper delivered by Diane Clements, Professor Diane Clements. Now, let me see. My notes on that. She was explaining that the Royal Arch was formed in 1713. Moderns formed, and she talked more about the moderns and the ancients. So the moderns had formed one in eight chapters. When we see what the ancients and moderns did with capitular masonry, and it was generally confined, the Royal Arch was generally confined to the city of London and Westminster. Back in 1800, the ancients were actually exalting more Masons than the moderns. But in 1840, about half of all acceptations took place in only 6 of 60 lodges. So remember, there were lodges going on, but not all of them practiced these degrees. And after the Union, the exaltations dropped off. But the moderns began increasing. So formerly it had been the ancients. Afterwards, it was the moderns. The lodges, after 1813, there were no more ancient. There weren't the ancients and moderns, but the lodges that had been assigned previously. So she was able to do some research and show us that the rate of exaltation being initiated did continue, and it shifted a bit. Now, Daniels previously had said that Freemasonry required men of means and leisures, and chapters were expensive to open and maintain. So if we're wondering why chapters didn't necessarily expand on the same level as lodges, one of the reasons was that equipping a chapter is expensive. And so while Freemasonry required men of leisure with the time and means with the money, and that didn't necessarily translate into a same support for chapter. And it wasn't support of the idea. It was support to be able to start a new chapter. It simply meant everything hit the ground. You needed money. So this made me think, as I was sitting there, that the cement of Freemasonry is idealism, which progressed through the degrees and affects men for the better. In other words, ethics. And that seems to be the drive behind capitular masonry. We know, of course, that at 1813, at the union of the ancients and moderns, there was a declaration that Freemasonry was going to occur to the benefit of the arts and sciences. In order, the goal was to produce universal peace and harmony, and we were going to. And the three parts of that were both a manual, an instrumental, and scientific reasoning. Speculative Freemasonry was intended for the cultural development of all the arts and sciences. That's in the day. Nobody's ever told me that. Nobody's ever told me that. Operative and speculative. Yeah, I've grown up with all my relatives having calloused hands from their labors. Operatives. So I don't need somebody telling me about that, I don't think. Well, they can. But I understand the effort, and I understand those are not silly, irrelevant men. And I also understand that they are men capable and willing and curious about metaphysics. So, yes, that happens. It's not just a degreed people or people with the advantage of having or the opportunity of having an advanced educational training. The training and education occurs through many different avenues. Like my friend John, who finished his PhD in mathematics and was working happily in the steel mills at Hamilton. One of the most interesting conversationalists I've ever had the pleasure. And he was completely happy with this whole process of being involved with the production of steel. So who's laughing now? So when I hear somebody talk about, you know, the spread in academia, it's like, really? Really? You're that competitive? So Freemasonry allows us to transcend that kind of notion, doesn't it? We're a fraternity. That doesn't mean we just welcome you. That means you have an obligation to extend that kind of thinking. You're part of us. I'm part of everything. You're part of it. I can't do Freemasonry without all of the rest. Freemasonry is this collective. And that's why I think I'm perhaps belaboring the point that it's important that we all feel part of the change. It's not change that is new and startling. When any tradesman found a new tool, a better tool that fit his hand to do the job with a greater degree of satisfaction, he used it. It wasn't that the old tool didn't have its place, but it was of the time. And today, that's continued. And has the art of doing things changed? Well, there are still people that preserve old ways and means. But we also have new, better, and more efficient at a price. Everything comes at a price for the thoughtful man. For the man who can't get over his own limitations, it's easy to use this kind of conversation to avoid doing things. Our sense of failure is easily exploited by simply finding reasons not to do things. It takes, in order to champion the kind of ideals and principles of Freemasonry, it takes an ability to be able to overcome that hesitation, to overcome that tendency to find barriers and to cling to them. So what? There's problems. So what? Find a way around them. That's why you're a Freemason. That's your opportunity. Find the solution that enables us to move ahead collectively and for the betterment of mankind. There, simple. Next, you're going to get into the distinctive differences within the early Royal Arch in England, how more incisive analysis may serve to illumine cultural divisions between the ancients and moderns prior to their union in 1813. And this is from E. John T. Eckester. It seems that the vexed question of how to reconcile varying views concerning the Royal Arch was the single most difficult problem faced by the Union exactly 200 years ago. It was fudged over at the 11th hour by the adoption of the infamous formula, pure ancient Freemasonry consists of 3 degrees and no more, viz. Those of the entered apprentice, fellowcraft, and the master mason, including the supreme order of the Holy Royal Arch. There you go. That's the quote. Difficulties continued very painfully for 2 decades. Remarkably, strains deriving from the final settlement still exist today.
Ah,
don't they now? This paper seeks to distinguish clearly between the emergent Holy Royal Arch within the ancients and the later distinction creation of the Grand and Royal Chapter of the Royal Arch of Jerusalem by members of the moderns. It examines the different philosophies of each and looks at the leading personalities and contrasting memberships. It explores the curiosity of why, despite the exalted status provided by membership, neither the moderns nor Irish nor the Scots Grand Lodge wish to accord separate recognition to the Royal Arch, despite many of their leading members belonging. It is no wonder that in 1813 the requirement laid down by the ancients that the craft union should include the Royal Arch nearly proved a stumbling block. But why should it still be a troublesome matter 2 centuries later? My question to you.
No, I'm not going to tell you how that was resolved. No. No, that was just too good.
There was a caution, there was a caution to withdraw ritual rather than include portions that might, for religious sensibilities, be offensive to some Masons. So when the ancients and moderns sat down, they had a sense that it was important not to offend people. So this notion, have you ever heard anybody claim that Freemasonry is a Christian organization? Well, there are places in the world where that is the case. These Grand Lodge of Sweden, where being a Protestant is a requirement. But that's not necessarily defining Freemasonry. If we look at the collectivity, the 3.5 million of us around the world, synthesizing principle was the result of effort to harmonize. The fact that some Grand Lodge oral histories meant the request by some could not be satisfied. The Roman Catholic Church remained a constant universal threat to Freemasonry. And even in Brussels, the Catholic Church in 1910, the universal ritual was discussed. And again in Lucerne in 1913. And this was an effort to try and come up with a universal ritual, and it failed. The predominance was, it's kind of interesting. Should we have, the question then was, should we have one ritual on the entire face of the earth? Very interesting question. Oh, whether we agree with that or whether we have our own opinion, I hope you certainly do. After all, you are a Freemason. But you can see that we felt a need to tackle these issues. Now, the Board of General Purpose, this is a paper by Paulo Arruda, and this was on the Board of General Purpose, a Masonic Tribunal, a review of the first 10 years of proceedings from 1813 to 1823. Born with the United Grand Lodge of England in December 1813 and under the direct auspices of the Duke of Sussex, Grand Master of Masons, the Board of General Purpose would soon be regarded as a Masonic tribunal. Although originally concerned with seemingly administrative and bureaucratic matters, it rapidly became an authoritative arbiter of disputes within English Freemasonry. The aggrandizement of its original functions can be traced through a close reading of the reports presented to Grand Lodge in the first 10 years of proceedings. However, in adjudicating between individual Masons or between members of the local lodge and their worshipful master, provincial Grand Lodge, and even the United Grand Lodge of England, the board did much more than simply mediate conflicts. It is this article's contention that in its recommendations, the board actively sought to reassert and shape certain singularities of Masonic life in broader terms, and aspects of character and behavior perceived to be Masonic especially. Considerations on the composition of the board and its members, as well as an analysis of specific case studies found in the reports recorded in Grand Lodge minutes from the period, corroborate this opinion. In its investigations, for instance, of the memorials brought to its attention, the board would not merely judge the validity of a case, but also often the character and ulterior motives of the parties involved, upholding fraternal love as well as responsibilities. Moreover, on more than one occasion, the board would also be tasked with ensuring the safeguard of order within the society, as it investigated cases of insubordination or even secession from United Grand Lodge of England, particularly as that assembly, itself a union of the premier moderns, Grand Lodge, and its ancient counterpart, sought to consolidate itself as a governing body. Just after your break, you came back to a session on Freemasonry and British identity. This was by the chair. The chair of this session was Susan Snell, Dr. Snell. And this is a paper by an American by the name of Sean Iyer. Oakley's Oration and Two Masonic Songs from Carmarthen, a thematic analysis of Masonic identity as expressed in literature connected to an early Welsh lodge. Now, I went to another, because these things are going on concurrently, two or three sessions. Now, this is an article about the architect Edward Oakley, who was a leading figure in a lodge warranted in Carmarthen in South Wales in 1724. Oakley served as provincial senior grand warden there, and by 1728 had relocated to London, becoming the master of a lodge meeting at the Carpenter's Arms in Silver Street. An oration that Oakley gave upon installation is being described by Knopp, Jones, and Hamer as one of the earliest statements we possess of the aims and objects of Freemasonry as set forth by a Mason of some standing. The speech outlines a vision of Freemasonry that promotes education in the arts and sciences, particularly architecture. It also stresses that a lodge should provide books to the brethren for the advancement of this divine science of masonry. Hear, hear. Hear, hear, Oakley. That was only 18th century, eh? 1728. Hear, hear. And do we do this today? Tisk, tisk. Let's get to it, eh? Every lodge should have... Here, I'll say it out loud. It should be a library. Comfortable overstuffed chairs, good lighting, quiet atmosphere for study. Period. You're not doing it, we're not doing it right. We. So we can do that collectively, can't we? And we do need people that are reading and studying to be able to share that, because not all of us have a lifestyle that allows for that amount of time, or not all of us have that kind of commitment. We can share. There's many different ways of learning. You can learn by experience. You can learn by reading. And we also learn by the behavior of other people, the ideas of other people. Also from the Lodge of Carmarthen are two songs first published in a curious collection of the most celebrated songs in honor of Freemasonry. That was 1731. And it was suggested that Oakley brought them from Carmarthen and popularized them. Oakley's Oration and the Songs from Carmarthen were published in various editions of Cole's Constitution, that's C-O-L-E-S, and provide a valuable window into the intellectual world of the craft during a critical period. This paper offers a careful thematic analysis of these three texts connected into South Wales, including an examination of the intertextuality with prior Masonic writings and exposures. Now let's move on to a really interesting paper by Ian McPhee and Grant McLeod. This is about Freemasonry and the military, exploring the ambiguities of alliance and obligation. Soldiers in the British military during the 18th century faced war in a number of theaters throughout the European continent, the Americas, and the colonies. Freemasonry in the late 18th and early 19th century was becoming, at least in part, more fluid and inclusive, where social standing and status could not only demonstrated and made clear, but could also provide a safe haven for political ideals considered radical and challenging. In the mid-18th century, Freemasonry was beginning to be perceived as an institution that offered brethren in a military lodge many benefits while serving overseas, while at the same time it had been convincingly argued that such activity supported an expanding British Empire. Again, from Jessica Harlam Jacobs, a book in 2007, on page 199, The British Empire. And, of course, those who have subscribed to the Sankey Lectures had the pleasure of hearing Dr. Jessica Harlan Jacobs from the University of Miami present her a talk on this very topic in St. Catharines. And she captured us all. She was riveting. What a speaker. In the film adaptation of the short story by Brother Kipling, The Man Who Would Be King, the two central protagonists, Danny and Peachy, are Freemasons attached to a British military traveling lodge in 19th century India. The film illustrates in an entertaining form that military lodges granted ambulatory warrants served several functions. We suggest that Freemasonry's elasticity and accommodation in religion and ideology made it useful in the British military for several reasons. By examining how Masonic prisoners of war were treated using case studies from the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, we revealed several contradictions in allegiance within Freemasonry and between Masons engaged in warfare. We suggest that military lodges at the height of their popularity first granted charters by the the Grand Lodge of Ireland served several functions: to create and maintain a sense of belonging and identity in men far from home, giving fellowship, conviviality, and assistance. Two, fostered a belief that being a Mason would result in some benefits should one be captured by an enemy. And three, facilitated the expansion of an ideology that supported and maintained a British Empire. Sort of the difference between seeing somebody that has they can only see blood in their eyes and listening to the old soldier who is able to relate to that sense of battle, to sit down with the former enemy. Interesting, isn't it? Then we get into post-war reconstruction and restitution. And this is by Hans Hermann Heumann of Germany. German Freemasonry after World War II, reconstruction between old structures and new tendencies. Are you surprised yet that this material is by scholars? Are you realizing that we are a phenomena? If you look at things in terms of phenomenology, we are a phenomenon in the face of the earth. That has nothing to do with how narrow or how broad we look at ourselves, whether we ever crack a book, whether we're only there for the social aspect. This notion that the point of Freemasonry is to be happy tends to, I think, address this through the wrong end of the binoculars. We're to bring harmony and contentment to the world. That doesn't necessarily mean that that Masons walk around in a state of euphoria. We have work to do. Here we have our German brethren, soldiers. Yeah. Reconstruction between old structures and tendencies. After the collapse of the Nazi system as the main outcome of World War II, and the consequent end of the ban on the existence and activities of Masonic lodges, German Freemasons were confronted with five major tasks. Can you imagine? 30,000, we know of, at least 30,000 Freemasons were put to death by the Nazis. And in this country, where there was this open wound, Germany, there were efforts. As early as 1945 at reconciliation, 1945 to 1949. Who else but brethren could take that courageous step? Talk about addressing the problem of balance, that feeling of exclusion. And who? Do I do that because my ego is wounded by some loutish comment? These are men that suffered in ways that I can only I don't have to get into that. You already know. You know, we know. So, they were confronted with five major tasks. To collect former Masons to reestablish lodges, to get the necessary approvals by the Allied occupational forces, and to obtain rooms for Masonic ceremonies because of the destruction of many lodge buildings and the slow process of restitution of lodge property confiscated by the Nazis. Nazis were a weird bunch. They set up a new Grand Lodge architecture, which should take the place of the fragmented German Grand Lodge system, which, with more than 10 Grand Lodges, as they had existed before 1933 to 1935. And third, to pursue a conceptual reorientation of German Freemasonry because of the right-wing, Volkisch orientation of large sections of German lodges and Grand Lodges, violating international Masonic principles. And four, to redefine the position of German Freemasonry vis-a-vis the political institutions in Germany, the various interest groups, the churches, the press, and other media of public information and opinion. And finally, to deal critically with the post-war manner of German Freemasons to tackle the political and ideological past of large sections of the Brotherhood in the time between 1920 and 1935. The aim of the paper is to highlight the main aspects of these five tasks and to report on the results obtained in the formative phase of German Freemasonry between 1945 and 1949. The paper will focus on the development of the humanitarian Freemasonry in Germany, especially on the process toward the establishment of United Grand Lodge of Freemasons of Germany in 1949. For it was mainly the unification process of the humanitarian Masons which created new Masonic structures and enabled the German Freemasonry to become both an element of a Western civil society, welcomed and supported by the Western Allies, and a part of the worldwide Masonic Brotherhood. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Amazing. And it's a tribute to all of our German brethren. And it helps us define the higher principles. If we're going to meet on a level, that's a principle that I would like to reach up to achieve, to be able to act and think in that manner at some point in my life. I'm willing to sacrifice and do what it takes to get there. And Helga Bjorn Horason did a paper then on restitution of Masonic archives and libraries after the Second World War. Can you imagine? During World War II, Masonic lodges all over occupied Europe experienced that their belongings were confiscated and stolen by the German occupants. We were fascinating, and our lodges were full of symbols. And we know that the Nazi administration had built a great deal of their thinking around this, the mysteries of a new brotherhood that they were forming. And of course, they would look at Freemasonry. Since 1945, European Freemasonry invested a lot of time and money trying to locate and get their belongings back. For different reasons, some have succeeded and some have not. And the paper was giving an overview of the history of Masonic repatriation work after the Second World War. And the author had completed two repatriation projects in Poland and Russia and is being used as a consultant on these issues by several European Grand Lodges. In other words, the work is still going on. Inventory archives and libraries of great cultural and economic value were transported to Berlin for evaluation, pseudo-scientific use, and used for displays in anti-Masonic exhibitions and museums by several Nazi organizations. So now you get to lunch. And this is one of the people chairing this. The person chairing this, Jan Schnuck, I think is one of the greatest minds. He is a foremost authority on fraternalism in the face of the earth. And he talked about internationally, he chaired this session on internationalism and standardization around 1900 towards the unification of Masonic rites and ritual systems. Yes, this is by, excuse me, This is by Dr. Joachim Berger of Germany. Internationalism and standardization around 1900 was toward a unification of Masonic rites and ritual systems. The period from the last third of the 19th until the first decade of the 20th century was an age of international standardization in the fields of trade, finance, and communication. In the field of culture and religion, the period around 1900 also marks the rise in ecumenism, the promotion of unity or cooperation between various religious denominations of Christianity. A similar development occurred in European Freemasonries. At first glance, the different strategies of Roman Catholic ecumenism and the multifaceted Protestant groups resembled those contending Masonic efforts to reach the ideal of a universal chain of brotherhood, the promoters of organizational unity in an international federation of grand lodges, for example, were not necessarily in line with those Masons who sought accord and unity in a unification of rites, ceremonies, and rituals. This paper aims to illuminate the interplay of these camps in Masonic internationalism around 1900s. Inter or even transnational harmonization via ritual was conceived on various levels. First, by attending a lodge workings of regular yet unfamiliar rites, that is, experiencing a common method in different forms of expression. This is a bilateral principle. Two, on international gatherings held with the ritual of the Holy Grand Lodge. This is a hegemonic principle, a teaching principle, so that you would get together and it would demonstrate. And third, on international gatherings held with the ritual of the cross-national ancient and accepted, (parentheses) Scottish rite, hidden hegemonic principle. Again, educational. And four, within the transnational organizations developed their own ritual for their ceremonies. We didn't even get through this, did we? Let me come back. That gives you a sample. Gives you a sample of what we're up against. What we have to coming our way very soon. Save up your money. Be sure you can get a comfortable room because it's not something you want to be traveling around back and forth. You want to be able to hunker down for a couple of days and listen. It's not a Masonic event. Our rank matters to us, but this is where we become the student and for the betterment of all people. Now, I hope you come back next week. I apologize for the gap in time, but I'll try and convince you over the next upcoming shows that the research and the investment in Edinburgh was well worth it. And in upcoming shows, I'll talk to you about my visit to St. Paul's Cathedral on Fleet at the end of Fleet Street in London. We stayed just a couple of doors up the street from the cathedral. Now, will you join with me in conducting as many acts of Masonic kindness over the next couple of days. I look forward to being with you again. Here's a little bit of parting music by a fairly new group. This is Graham Dalby and the Graham-O-Phones. Haha, no relation. It's from an album called Slow Foxtrot. I look forward to being with you again. See ya.